I was almost asleep before I remembered that at midnight it would be my 7th birthday. I'd been thinking about it before I fell asleep, but when Tony woke me up and dragged me off to his house and then onto a train, I'd been so excited that I'd forgotten. I was very happy when I remembered, because now I would not be a little boy anymore. That's what my dad had said, that 7 is not a little boy, but not a grown-up boy either. I looked over at Tony, who was slumped against the window with his eyes wide open, which was just as creepy as Dad said it was. Then I looked at Mr. Sneedlesnark, who wasn't asleep either, but had just sat back down in his seat. I wondered where he had gone. He looked a little sweaty and nervous, but maybe that was because I was staring at him. I hoped it was. My dad is very polite and does not stare at people unless he has a reason. But when he does, people get super nervous and either start talking very fast or try to run away. I wished I could make people do that. So I narrowed my eyes at Mr. Sneedlesnark and turned them icy blue with lots of gold sparkles, the same colour my dad's eyes were when the Dementors got after me. Mr. Sneedlesnark spluttered and nearly fell out of his seat. It was brilliant. I'm definitely going to do that again. My heavens, whatever have you done with your eyes? It is quite disturbing. I knew he was trying to sound stern, but his voice came out a little squeaky. I noticed this because I have been taught to be observant. Dad says it will help me live longer, although I don't know why. I did not answer Mr. Sneedlesnark's question about my eyes because I wasn't certain what I should say, and I wanted to observe him anyway. I noticed ink smudges under his fingertips that hadn't been there before, and that his shoes were tatty and scuffed up. Then I thought about what those two things might mean. His shoes were not nice, and librarians wore nice shoes, and they also did not match his fancy suit. They were shoes for running away fast. Was he really a librarian? The ink smudges under his fingernails must have come from an owl he had written when he got up. On the big night trains like this one, there is always an owl window with an owl in a cage on a little desk and a quill and ink and parchment. It's so you can send owls home if the train is late or you decide to apparate or Kingsley has aggravated you and you've just thought of what you want to say to him. Well, I've never sent an owl from a train. Those are all owls my dad has sent. I want to, though. To whom did you send the owl? I asked Mrs. Sneedlesnark in a friendly voice. If he were really a librarian, I thought, he would be impressed by my excellent grammar. But he was not. My sister, he said, but he said it just a little too quick. I am on my way to visit my sister in Calais. That meant he would be crossing the channel with us. Why would a librarian cross the channel in the middle of the night? Most people will not work all day and then stay up all night unless they have to. Is she sick? I said in a very nice voice. And then I wanted to kick myself because I had just given him an excuse. An alibi, that is what it is called. Yes, I'm afraid she is ill. Demon pox. Mr. Sneedlesnark said in a sad, grave voice. Like she was already dead. He sounded truthful, but I didn't believe him. Maybe I was just bored and looking for something suspicious, which Dad says I do sometimes. But not to worry, because Sirius did the same thing. I didn't think I was, though. I had a feeling in my stomach that he was lying. My dad taught me a spell that will show the very last message sent from an owl, I chirped up proudly. I can go look at that message you wrote your sister. Mr. Sneedlesnark's ears started turning red. I know he believed me because I'm a very good liar. Dad says it comes naturally to the blacks. That is not always a bad thing. It's okay with God if you lie to bad people to save someone from getting hurt, like spies do. I didn't know if Mr. Sneedlesnark was going to hurt anybody, but if he was lying and was a bad person, then he might be going to. And he was acting more suspicious all the time. He was not happy at all with what I had said. You sit in your seat and keep quiet, he told me in his threatening voice. It didn't sound anything like his fake nice librarian voice. And Tony sat up and looked at him. I guess Mr. Sneedlesnark thought Tony was sleeping because he's stupid and doesn't know vampires hardly ever sleep.
"Your young friend here has been quite rude to me," he told Tony. "I've not," I burst in before Tony could start scolding me. "He's a bad person, Tony, and he has sent a secret owl, and he is not even really a librarian." Tony might not have been sleeping, but he was just as crabby as a normal person who gets woken up. "Well," he said to me, looking all huffy and irritable, "what business is it of yours if he has sent an owl, Teddy? And why does it matter if he's a librarian or not?"
"Because he's lying," I shouted and started thinking myself. People who lose their tempers do not think clearly, like my dad has taught me to do when I'm upset, so I calmed down. "Why would he lie about being a librarian and about the owl he sent, Tony? There's a reason he will not say what it is. I think it's very suspicious."
"I do not need to answer to you for anything," Mr. Needlesnark said, and he sounded very angry. "I believe it is best if we no longer converse."
He turned his face the other way. If he lost his temper, I thought, then he would not think clearly, and then he might say something that would give him away. I wasn't certain how to make him lose his temper, so I just pretended to be me dad, which is something I like to do anyway. It makes me braver and helps me think of how to talk to someone or what to do. "You ought to be nervous," I told him in a very pleasant voice, "because I know you're up to no good, and I'm going to find out what it is. And if you mess with me or Tony, I will kill you. Or my dad will," I added. "Ha! He did lose his temper then. I am not afraid of you," he snarled back, "and I certainly am not afraid of your father." Tony sniffed and drew himself up very straight in his seat and waved his hands around.
"Then you, sir, are a fool as well as a liar," he told Mr. Needlesnark, and I gave him a big smile. I love it when Tony is haughty. "And I will have you know that I myself am quite learned in matters of defence."
Well, Tony does know about matters of defence. He just isn't any good at them. And that was when the train pulled into the station at Rye. Mr. Needlesnark jumped up from his seat and hurried away as fast as he could, and everyone else on the train got up stretching and yawning and blocking the aisle. Well, I wasn't worried about losing sight of Mr. Needlesnark, because if he was going to cross the channel, he would be on the same ferry we would, and it isn't very big. While Tony was using the toilet, I took my wand out of my knapsack and put it in my cloak pocket, far enough back that nobody could see it, but not so far back that I couldn't grab it very fast. After Tony bought the tickets, I sidled up beside him and put on an innocent face. I'd been waiting all night to tell him something, and I couldn't wait any longer. "Tony," I said seriously, "what was it like crossing the channel when you were, well, before you were a vampire?"
"Oh, my! It was extraordinarily horrific!"
He shuddered and shook all over.
"You cannot possibly conceive of the soul-shattering, mind-boggling nightmare which lay in store for any terrified creature that dreamt of crossing the channel."
"Why?"
"Oh, I do not even wish to think on it, Teddy. Oh, my, how dreadful, how desolate! How drear are those memories! There was a
his voice quivered,
"a monstrous demon, a one-eyed phantasm of the deep, a 500-year-old ferryman who took groups of 20 across on a skiff. You know what a skiff is?"
"Well, of course I do. Then what happened?"
"Oh!"
Tony burst into tears.
"That ravenous beast, that soulless hellmonger, he would select one hapless soul to consign to the depths as we all watched in helpless fright. He would fling the poor wretch into the sea."
He wiped his eyes and blew his nose noisily. What is the fairy like now, my love?"
"It is just this. Well, I've made a dreadful mistake, and now I'm confused. Sorry, I'm going to go back because I can't go back with this dumb thing. Sorry. What is the fairy like now, my love?"
"Oh, it is just the same, Tony," I squealed with delight.
I couldn't help it. You would have done it too if you'd seen the look on his face. And it is the same ferryman, only now he's 1,000 years old.
You are joking. You are, you are.
I swear on my honour I'm telling the truth, I said solemnly, and Tony staggered and toppled over onto a little old witch.
I cannot, I simply cannot, he moaned.
You've already bought the tickets, Tony, I said, and I was very excited. They are magical tickets. You remember, once you buy them, you have to get on the ferry. I wanted to do a little dance, like Tim used to do when he was really happy about something, but I have to have dragged Tony towards the exit, and he was very heavy. He kept moaning and sobbing as we went out the door, and then walked down the shingle. It was the loveliest night you ever saw, and the sea was bright and calm, and the air smelled good, and all the seagulls ran around my feet like they were glad to see me. This was the best birthday night ever! There it is, I hollered and yanked harder on Tony's sleeve. Come on, I see the ferryman. I love the ferry. I do love the ferry. The ferryman is very, very scary looking, but I'm not afraid of him, and he is my friend. I took a St. Port's flag out of my knapsack and tied it around my forehead like a pirate, because that's what keeps me safe. The flag belonged to my other grandfather, my dad's dad, who was once warden of the St. Ports, and he and all his descendants are forever protected from the ferrymen. That's the other reason I like the ferry. It is never me or my dad that get thrown over. We just sit down and eat our lunch and don't worry about it. I told Tony this, but it did not make him very happy.
Well, yes, that is all well, very well for you, he screamed like a girl. I imagine you will simply wave a careless goodbye as I plummet into the abyss.
Look, I pointed, and Tony lifted his eyes, only for a second, towards the ferry. The sky around the skiff was clear and beautiful, but above it lightning bolts and hail and rain were crashing down onto the ferryman. He was standing in his oilskin plus fours and waving his staff and yelling, Who's going to die tonight? I laughed out loud and tugged Tony closer. The ferryman's face was all swelled up and squishy with crusty warts and oozing things all over his forehead and nose and one blood-red eye that was slime-crusted and dripping. The other was covered by the dirtiest eye patch you ever saw. Hello, I called out, because I like him and I think he is funny. His father was a kraken or something, and he is immortal and super strong. Guess who I am?
St. Port Warden Descendant, he rasped out in a cheery voice. Lots of them over the past 800 years. What makes you think I know you, Teddy Lupin?
We both started laughing and I yanked Tony towards the shore. Tony did not get thrown into the water. It was a little old lady witch he'd fallen against. He blubbered and cried and carried on after she was tossed, till the other passengers told him to shut up. I could have told him that for the last 150 years the Rye Harbour rescue boat secretly follows the ferry out, and that the old witch would be swaddled up in warm blankets right now, with sailors fussing over her, but he'd not told me happy birthday, so I didn't want to tell him. We'd barely got into the train station at Calais when Tony headed off towards a dark platform without even stopping to look at the leaving board or anything.
It is platform Q, he said in this voice that sounded like a person who knows everything there is to know in the whole world. The ticket inspector in Rye told me we simply needed to find platform Q once we changed at Calais.
Tony was walking very fast, which was rude because it's hard for a normal human to keep up with a vampire, especially when that person has short legs. It was also hard to talk to him when I was running to keep up with him. I think that's why he was doing it. Was Mr. Sneedlestock ahead of you in the queue, Tony? I demanded, and he slowed down to answer me.
Well, yes, whatever does that matter? He griped and sped right back up. And do not start up again with your...
Because he could have bribed the ticket inspector into saying that.
Oh, stars above, God in heaven, I'm unutterably weary with your continual suspicions. You simply wish to play games and I...
It is not a game, I yelled and tried to tell myself to not lose your temper. You will not think clearly, but it didn't work. There are lots of reasons to be suspicious of Mrs. Needlesnot, Tony, and people bribe ticket inspectors all the time.
Oh, How do you know this? Tony said in a cold voice. Tony is my friend, but sometimes he is so stupid I want to choke him to death.
Everybody knows that, Tony. And if he didn't bribe him, he could have just confounded him into saying it. That's the easiest charm in the whole world.
We had gone a long way down that long, dark platform by now. Big red cue suddenly erupted over our heads like a star, and Tony stopped really fast, and I ran into him.
I don't like the look of that cue, Tony, I yelled, because I didn't. It is cursed. There was loads and loads of bad magical energy pouring off that cue, and Tony just looked up as if it were a street sign in Ferncliff. Before I could say anything else, a great black train blowing nasty red smoke screamed into the station and stopped beneath that evil cue.
Oh, you bothersome and malcontented child, Tony screamed and dragged me onto the train by the back of my cloak. Tony's not very strong, but he's still a grown-up. Why can't I be big and strong like my dad? I would knock Tony down and just walk away. But I couldn't, so I didn't. After Tony hauled me onto that train, he sat down on a wooden bench and stared straight ahead with his arms folded across his chest. I threw my knapsack down on the floor as the train lurched out of the station and neither of us said a single word to each other. The only other person on the train was an old lady with curly grey hair under a frilly checkered bonnet. She wore a baggy green dress with a ruffled white collar and big brown boots, and she was feeding the biggest goose you ever saw. It was almost as tall as Tony. The lady turned around and started talking to us, like old ladies do on trains.
He always wants broccoli, she said in this exasperated voice, and it gives him gas. Don't look at me like that, Lester. It does.
Tony stared at the goose's red velvet bow tie and puffy silk stockings and clapped his hands.
Are you a talking goose?
He said in a super excited voice.
I've not seen one of the large geese since 1509.
There are very few of us left, Lester squawked. Perhaps because we're rarely fed, he added crossly.
Oh, well, yes, you're just skin and bones, the old lady told him, but she looked at us while she was talking. Next thing you know, he'll be complaining about his clothes. He likes to dress up in my bonnets. Makes him feel fancy. Don't look at me like that, Lester. Don't do it if you don't want people talking about it.
I hate you, Lester said.
Tony let out this happy little shriek, because he's the most embarrassing grown-up in the world. Why, you are Mother Goose, he trilled out. I do remember you hearing you give a story time when I was 5 years old.
There is no such person as Mother Goose, I said. Maybe there used to be, but there hasn't been for at least 200 years. I learned that in school.
I don't get out much these days, dearie,
the old lady said primly and fussed with her collar.
Would you want to drag this old goose round the continents, telling stories to ungrateful little children who always interrupt? I keep to myself in my cabin now. But Lester will wander off, and this time he got himself all the way to Calais before I could retrieve him.
Lester farted really loud, and he didn't look the least bit sorry about it.
I was trying to run away, he said in a gloomy voice.
Yes, for the millionth time, and heaven knows where we are going now. When I spotted him at the rail station, he just took off for this dreadful train and climbed aboard. Wherever is this train going?
Transylvania,
Tony said and glared at me like he was daring me to say he was wrong.
We don't know that for certain, I told the goose lady in a haughty voice, just to aggravate Tony. He hates it when other people are haughty. I guess he thinks he's the only one who should be allowed to do it.
Someone told us that, but they were not a very trustworthy someone.
I suppose we shall see, she yawned and turned back round on her bench. If I don't like the looks of it, I'm not getting out of the train.
I simply cannot wait to depart from this train, Tony said loudly.
But she didn't say anything else. I think she was as tired of us as she was of Lester. The train was old and smelly and dirty, and it did not have cozy, comfortable train cushions or floating lanterns or even a fire. It was so cold our breath made little white puffs in the air.
Tony conjured up two woolen blankets that were very girly and sparkly, but I was so cold that I wrapped up in one anyway. The train went on and on and on until I finally fell asleep, and when I woke up, Tony had put his cloak round me and cuddled me up so I'd not fall off the bench, and we forgot about being angry with each other. When the train stopped, we got out, but the goose lady stayed on. The train station was all closed up and we couldn't see anything, so we walked around to the front. And it was not a nice place at all. The sky was dark and cloudy and all covered with ash. You could tell nothing grew here, not a tree or a shrub or even a blade of grass, and the air smelled like sulphur, and a filthy black rain was pouring down from the sky. We walked up the road and saw rows and rows of undead soldiers marching along the wide and perfectly straight streets. Well, Tony started shuddering and howling, and the soldiers stopped and started towards us. "Be quiet, Tony," I hissed. "Go back to your march," I yelled at the inferi, and they turned around and went back in their rows.
"Oh, yes, I should have known," Tony mumbled sulkily. "The blacks can always control inferi."
"I can't help it if we work well with the dead, Tony." Tony just rolled his big eyes.
"We shall be frozen," he screamed and stamped his boot. "We have no sustenance. We shall be found dead by the roadside, stiff and lifeless and cold as..."
"Tony," I interrupted. "I've juice and milk and sandwiches in my thermos. Then you can make us fur-lined travelling capes."
"Oh, my wretched feet. My draining bunions, my swollen calluses, I cannot endure it."
I don't know how my dad got through the First War without killing Tony. Sometimes he says he doesn't know either. I was just wondering how we'd ever get to the castle when a big cart with two man-sized wheels rolled up behind us. The cart was piled high with sacks, and six tall goblins were pulling it. I'd never seen a tall goblin before, so I was very excited. They had bulgy eyes and long noses and chins and extra long arms with lots of fingers. Each one wore a leather harness around its chest and an iron collar about its throat, and the collars chained the goblins to the cart. Walking beside the cart was a small man wearing a dark smock and trousers and holding a worn riding crop in his right hand.
"Ho, ho!"
he said, and held up his hand for the goblins to stop.
"What have we here? British wizards?"
I should have wondered how a peasant man living somewhere in Eastern Europe could speak English so well, but I didn't. And now it's too late.
"In need of a lift to the castle, are we?"
"Why, yes, indeed we are,"
Tony said, and smiled his big smile.
"You have certainly happened along at a most auspicious moment. Why, I can scarcely walk another step, and we have no idea how to get to the castle." "It's up the mountain there,"
the man replied calmly.
"You can't see the mountain, mind you, what with all the ash in the air, but it is there."
"The prince's castle is in the hills, Tony," I said sternly. "Remember, Dad has to climb up mountains to get to the cave. The castle is a long road, and it's up a winding path, and that's where it is."
"Oh, pish posh," Tony told me, which was very rude. "Hills, mountains, they're all the same thing."
He pulled out a purse full of gold coins, pulled it out of his shoe, and he started counting some money out, and the man told one of the goblins to put his hands out so Tony could step into the cart. A different goblin just picked me up and set me right down on one of those sacks, which was very embarrassing. Then the man cracked his whip at the goblins and the cart started bouncing up a steep road.
"We are most grateful if you are taking us to the castle,"
Tony said loudly and looked at me, but I didn't say anything.
I wasn't grateful. I thought it was very cruel how the man whipped those poor goblins.
"We don't even know him, Tony," I grumbled and tried to get comfortable on the lumpy brown sack. Something was poking me right in the bottom. "Why are we even going with him?"
"I believe he's a very kind fellow."
"You don't know. You're a terrible judge of character."
"Oh, and who told you that?"
I know he knew who had told me that. "I will tell you one thing, Tony," I shouted. "There is an elbow poking in my bottom, and I just felt a head and two knees in this sack. These sacks are full of dead people, Tony."
"Oh, sweet, merciful Lord in heaven, help me, help me,"
Tony wailed. He started leaping up and falling right back down onto the sacks, which is just about the funniest thing you ever saw. I laughed so hard I almost fell out of the cart. The man driving the goblins with his whip looked over his shoulder at Tony.
The dead have never harmed anyone yet, he said calmly. There is nothing to fear. Besides that, you are immortal.
He sounded kind of disgusted with Tony when he said this last bit, and who could blame him? Tony's the biggest Hufflepuff there ever was. He won't admit it, but my dad looked it up in Professor McGonagall's super-secret old record book, and Tony was the Hufflepuff prefect in 1489. Tony stopped jumping and stood up, trying not to let a sack touch him, but there were too many sacks, and they were all piled around his legs. He started blubbing, and the man driving the goblin cart looked at me like he felt sorry for me. See? You'll never listen to me, Tony, I hollered. I shouldn't have hollered him while he was crying, but he never learns. Why would anyone take bodies up to a prince's castle? They might take bodies away if the people got sick and died there, but why would anyone take them there?
I don't ask, the driver yawned. I've got to learn a living same as everyone else, don't I?
That cart wound round and round for hours up that mountain, and the lumpy sacks got more and more uncomfortable, and Tony finally couldn't stand it any longer and sat down on a sack and started sobbing into his lace magenta handkerchief. That's his favourite handkerchief to cry in. And don't call it purple, or you will get a great big speech about his dead cats, fuchsia and lavender and lilac and heliotrope, that will go on and on until you want to kill yourself. Finally, we reached the back of a big black castle with lots of pointy spikes and turrets and drawbridges and things. It was super cool, and I started feeling better. Then the man pulled the goblin cart up to a brown-studded door near some bushes, and when I looked up, there was an ogre taller than a tree standing there staring at us.
Here they are,
the little man said to the ogre, and I wondered for a minute if he was talking about the dead people and the sacks, or about Tony and me. I had a bad feeling I knew which it was.
Take him to the prince.
And then the ogre started leaning down towards us. Tony jumped down the side of the cart opposite the ogre and sprawled out onto snowy grass. But I climbed down and walked right up to him so he would know I wasn't scared. Well, I walked up to his knees. That ogre was at least 15 feet tall and probably weighed 700 pounds or more. And his beard and hair were black and bushy and curly, and his face was flat and broad with a pair of floppy ears like a dog's and two yellow tusks just out of his lower lip. He looked down at me and I looked up at him. There was a burlap sheet tied about his waist and covered him to the top of his knees, but his hard, muscular chest and arms and shoulders were all exposed with lots and lots of pea-green skin glistening in the rising sun. Yeah, great big hands that looked like they could wrap round somebody's skull and crush it. He said with this sneering look on his face. Tony clutched his throat and backed away.
Ogres liked to roast people over fires, he said in a whispery voice and swayed back and forth. Their favourite treat is human skin. Oh, merciful Christ! He will peel us like apples and feast on our intestines!
The ogre replied, like he was saying, you're right on that, mate. The ogre stepped forward and pulled Tony up under his right arm, and then he reached down for me. I knew I couldn't get to my wand, and I almost froze up, but then I heard my dad's voice in my head. The way to kill an ogre that gets too close is to climb him. So, that was what I did. I ducked away from his hand and grabbed his burlap skirt thingy and pulled myself up to his waist. I think the ogre was kind of startled. If he hadn't had two big metal nipple rings, I would have been in trouble, because I never could have climbed up that smooth belly and chest. But I grabbed those rings and used my feet to get up to his shoulders and head. The ogre laughed.
I crouched down and grabbed his giant ear with my left hand and looked at that big filmy blue eyeball that was closest to me. It was about 2 foot long by 1 foot wide. I did not like how big that eyeball was, but I didn't give myself time to think on it. If you're standing up, you can reach the dagger or knife in your belt faster, but if you're crouched down, you can get the knife in your boot quickest. That's why you put one there. I grabbed that knife from my boot and I stabbed it into the corner of that ogre's eyeball as far back up as I could, just like my dad taught me. He let me practice on some dead trolls he got from the oral department, but we can't tell Kingsley. Those dead trolls do not come cheap. They are for aura students in training. That's what Kingsley would have said. The ogre pitched straight forward and I jumped off and rolled to the ground so he wouldn't land on me. He must have dropped Tony when he fell because I heard a loud thump and then Tony screaming about his shattered bones. The man with the goblins in the cart looked at the dead ogre and turned around as quickly as he could. They rattled off down the road while Tony rolled about in the snow. Get up, Tony, I hissed. You can't just lie there in the snow. We have to get inside.
How cruel and wretched and deplorable child that you are. How can you have no sympathy for...
I am going in, Tony, I shouted. You can stay there and holler all you want. Then I hurried up to that big studded brown door and I pulled on the latch as hard as I could. It opened very easily, and when I walked in, Tony hurried in behind me, looking sulky as you please. I picked up a torch from the ground and yelled, Incendio! So we could see, and the torch shot up a hot orange flame straight into the darkness. We were in a narrow hallway that was only about 5 feet wide, with the ceiling so high it was lost in the darkness. Lining the walls were carvings of faces, ghastly faces with gaping mouths and wild eyes. And suddenly, all those mouths began moving at once. Help us, they moaned. Help us, help us, help us. The groaning became a chant.
Oh, do be quiet, Tony shrieked. I tell you, I can bear no more. There's nothing we can do, really, I said apologetically.
By the time we got to the end of the corridor and made a turn, Tony was moaning again about his pitiful legs and the blisters on his feet, but he stopped complaining when a great yellow wind came rushing towards us.
It is the creeping death, he screamed. Make haste, I tell you, make haste.
He is so dramatic. It is fog, I said and pulled a face. It's fog, Tony, that is all. Then I noticed two men standing about 20 feet from us talking, and when those gusts of churning yellow air hit them, they just fell over dead. All right, I said impatiently. Maybe it is cursed fog.
That is what the creeping death is, Tony wailed. Run, I tell you, run!
We turned round and barreled the other way down the corridor. I ran with my head down and arms tucked to my sides, my legs pumping fast the way I'd been taught, and I shot past Tony, who was flailing and careering and bouncing off the walls. Fly, Tony, fly! I yelled and kept on running.
I cannot possibly endure it,
Tony disappeared, and I saw a very small, dun-coloured bat with wild eyes dipping and diving above my head. Good job, Tony! I yelled to encourage him, but didn't seem to help very much. The bat could fly as fast as I could, but not any faster. All of a sudden, an open doorway loomed up in front of us, and I somersaulted twice into the room and came to a stop standing with my wand out. The bat hit the wall and slid down very slowly. It was a beautiful morning and very peaceful.
Mopping up Tony's mess hadn't taken a great deal of time. I vanished every trace of him from the crime scene, tucked his wand inside my cloak and planted some evidence from the house of an old warlock I knew who lived down at the Isle of Dogs and definitely deserved a murder charge. When I handed him over to Scotland Yard, they were extremely pleased and I was home just after midnight. Elizabeth was awake and still upset, but we both apologised for our earlier quarrel and put the blame on Tony, which settled the matter nicely. I sat in my study looking through the stack of owls Elizabeth keeps tidily arranged for me while I'm away. She was downstairs playing a piano, a lilting, lovely melody, Scottish-sounding, Schubert, maybe. Made me glad to hear it. Annie was having a sleep in her room down the corridor, and when I stopped and listened, I could hear her quiet breathing. Pale sunlight streaked through the window onto the desk.
I had it cracked open a bit and could smell the first hint of spring on the horizon. Today was Teddy's birthday. Liz planned a party for the evening, but he was at school now. Since I'd been late back, she let me sleep in, but I wished I'd been up to tell him happy birthday this morning. I decided to walk up to the school when it was time to collect him, so we could spend some time together before the house filled up with guests. The most hideous bird you can possibly imagine dropped down in front of my window, its fanged mouth open and blood-red eyes glowering at me with a nasty, sentient stare. I opened the window a foot and glared back. It's not always easy to channel your inner werewolf when you're in a fine mood, but the creature had a certain hostile aggressiveness I didn't care for. It dropped a scroll onto the floor and then spat upon it. Well, no problem channeling now. Here was this creature, inside the house where my wife and children lived, behaving like this. "Get the hell away from my house," I snarled. "I shall do as I please," the beast hissed, and when I looked at him, he burst into flames. I really wish I could do that all the time. It's quite satisfying. The blackened bird dropped backwards onto the ground, landing with a dull thwack in the shrubbery, and I snatched up the parchment and impatiently flung it across my desk. A lock of Teddy's hair and a sleeve from his cloak lay on top of the missive. I can't. This isn't real. No, this isn't happening. I can smell Teddy's scent from the piece of cloak. I know it's his hair. I know it's his cloak. This can't be. The words on the parchment are swimming in heavy black ink. The words say he's dead. They say he was tortured in the usual manner by Bloodwyn Blood, the way he kills young boys, and the room tilts and the furniture's out of proportion. The window recedes, the table's too big, and everything's blurred. I'm on my knees on the floor and I can't breathe. Something's pulling at the root of my soul with a pain worse than 100 transformations. I can't let it in. Behind the pain, there's a wall of terror. I can't. This isn't real. This can't be. I don't. I can't. A breeze flutters through the window, ruffling the lock of Teddy's hair. The sun is well up now, and the room is bathed in it. Liz is still playing the piano. Teddy's at school. He's at school. Somehow they got this from his room. Dora. I don't know how, but he's at school. I try to shout for Liz, but no sound comes from my mouth. Did she see him this morning? Sometimes if Annie sleeps in, she sleeps in a bit later as well, and Teddy will cock up breakfast and go off to school with Morgana. He's at school. This is not real. I can always read Teddy, no matter where he is. Maybe not the exact sentence that's passing through his mind, but the gist of his thoughts, whether he's happy or angry or sad. So I reach out in my head to find him. He isn't there. He isn't anywhere. I can't breathe. I grip the table legs. He isn't there. He isn't there. They've... Inside the room, I see at least a dozen men. Great, big, mean-looking men with swords and daggers and wands and maces and all sorts of weapons. They'd be interesting to look at if they weren't all aimed at me. I need to think and think quick. There isn't any way to escape. I pick up Tony the Bat and stuff him in my knapsack, and the men don't even seem to notice.
You come with us,
one of them demands in bad chopped-up English. He's a giant man with angry eyes and a ginormous vein throbbing on his temple like an angry worm. His voice sounds like he's in one of those muggle horror films.
You come now!
I sigh and put my wand back in my cloak, although I keep my hand on it. And I'm happy Tony is still passed out in my knapsack. The corridors are cold and dirty and the torchlight is purple, and I feel glad for a moment when the men push through some big heavy doors into a room that looks like a giant barn from before the Middle Ages. I like the rushes across the floor and the tall fireplaces and floating candles and good food smells. Then I look up at the long table on the platform. A row of vampires is sitting at the table with an important vampire in the middle.
Just like Jesus at the Last Supper, except that middle vampire is definitely not Jesus. He is the scariest person I've ever seen, and looking at him gives me a cold, dead feeling inside. His eyes are cruel and his skin is grey, which means he's very, very old. Vampires start to go off when they're 1,000 years old. The nasty vampire prince, and that's what I decide he must be, because he's wearing thick red velvet robes and loads of jewels, stares at me, and not in a nice way.
"Welcome to Moldavia, son of Remus Lupin," he says in his cold, rough voice and raises up his goblet. Then he looks me over and licks his lips. "I am Blodvin Blood. My, you are an attractive boy."
"Ew, he's a pedo. You better not think he's going to stick anything in my butthole." "You let me go," I shout and kick a man standing beside me to make my point. "You let me go or I will kill you and all your men." Everybody at the table laughs and laughs when I say this, and I grip my wand and squeeze it tight.
"Do you even know where you are, boy?"
the awful man says, like he doesn't really care. "I know where I am. I'm in a great big ugly castle on stupid evil Death Eater Street," I yell. It feels a lot better being angry than scared.
"You little fool," he says in a calm voice that makes me want to hit him. "You attempt to anger me when this will only increase the time of your torture. Seize him."
He waves at the other vampires and they start coming towards me in a great crush. And then a young man leaps down from the rafters. He lands at the end of the table and stands. I only see his face for a second, but he looks like a seventh year, and he's very handsome. He's wearing leather breeches and a white silk shirt and a very fancy purple cloak. He's holding his wand in one hand and a long, curved katana sword in the other. I don't recognize him, but I think the people at the table do. A whole lot of them jump up and start backing away. That Blodwin doesn't, though. He just curls up his lip and sneers. Then the man throws out his wand and a long whip shoots out of the tip and it snaps around the necks of the four men closest to me. Slice, and the heads roll off onto the floor. He is wicked cool. I want to clap my hands and cheer, but then I remember I should be fighting too. I pull out my wand and point it at Blodwin and yell, "Confringio!" because that's my best spell and it took me 6 whole months to learn it. I reckon Blodwin is behind a shield charm because nothing happens to him, but his big black table cracks in half and all the silver goblets and smoking pipes and food slide down onto the floor. But I'm so angry that nothing hit him. He's evil and nasty and bad and I want to kill him. I jump across the table and crash right through that shield charm, which is like busting through a thick wall of glass. And then I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to stab him in the heart. And I stab him somewhere. I feel the knife go in and pull it out quick, and then all these arms start grabbing me and tugging me in different directions. It's very loud. There's a lot of shouting and banging and screaming and spell yelling, and I just keep punching and kicking at everyone.
"Be still," someone hisses in my ear in English. "I'm your father's friend."
The man from the rafters is holding me against his chest, and I stop fighting. He throws his cloak over both of us and leaps back into the air. We're flying! We're flying so fast and high! And people are blasting at us from down the ground and then from up on the rafters. And then everything goes black and I can't see at all.
"Peruvian darkness powder,"
the man whispers in my ear.
"Climb on my back."
I do what he says, adjusting my swinging knapsack so it won't slide off. I don't want that Bagwatoni in it to fall down into Blodwin's den.
"Tuck your head down and close your eyes."
I obey him right away, and I'm glad that I did, because we fly straight through a wooden roof, and it does not feel good at all. But I can tell I didn't break anything or get any wood splinters in my eyes, and then I'm all right. The top of the roof is very cold and very big, and huge gusts of wind are howling around us, and the man stands over me frowning, and then he leans down and starts talking.
"I shall change into my bat form," he tells me. "Hold on to my wings so that you will not fall. Grip my sides with your thighs as you would ride a thestral. It will not be easy. Can you do this?"
I nod. I guess I'll find out soon enough if I can do it.
"Leave the bag."
"No, no," I shout in panic. "My friend Tony's in there. Tony's in his bat form." He looks at my little knapsack with a strange expression. Another vampire starts crashing through the roof.
"Very well, now."
In a split second, the man vanishes and a giant vampire bat stands in front of me. I jump as high as I can to get on his back and grab his wings like he said, squeezing my legs against his body. I am flying on the back of a vampire bat. This is the best birthday ever. It doesn't quite seem so wonderful when we get high up in the air, though. It's so cold my nose and ears are frozen like solid lumps and my throat and chest burn all the way down every time I take a breath. I'm shaking so hard from the cold I know I'm going to fall off, but I hang on and say a prayer, and pretty soon we're landing on a snowy forest path. Other vampires are dropping down beside us, too. I slide off very fast and the man reappears without a sound. He swings me up in his arms and then he and I and Tony in the knapsack disappear with a loud bang. Now we are in a big room with paintings and tapestries and thousands of books. A bald man with a beard hurries up and takes me from the man's arms. He wraps me up in warm blankets and sets me down on a soft sofa, and someone hands me a big steaming silver mug of hot cocoa. The man is crouching down in front of his fire and cracking up the flames until they are dancing, and soon the room feels so warm and lovely. He turns and looks at me. He's covered in wood splinters and snow and has cuts all over his face.
"You must tell your father you have seen this," he says calmly, like nothing at all has even happened. "He will never believe that I have turned up my fire."
Then I know who he is. He's the one we were trying to find in the first place. He's Prince Liviu Radu of Transylvania, and that is Barnabas with the bald head and beard. This is the place we meant to go all along. "We were trying to come here," I blurt out. "We got on the wrong train." The prince does not look like someone who is surprised by much, but he raises an eyebrow. Then I remember I haven't even said thank you, and I feel awful. "Thank you for saving me," I say, and I feel like I want to cry, but I don't. "Thank you very much, Your Majesty." I try to get up and bow, but he points back to the couch.
"You may recline," he says sternly. "I have not saved your life to have you become ill. Rest."
I don't feel badly. And I don't. I feel happy and excited. I'm safe and so is Tony. I'm so happy to be out of that awful castle. And I am glad remembering that I was brave. Did I stab him in the heart? I practically yell. I hope that I did.
"I believe you stabbed his arm," the prince says in a kind voice. "Something which no other child on earth could possibly have accomplished. When you leapt at him, I knew he would take your knife from you and cut your throat. That was when I reached for you."
"Well, maybe it wasn't very bright of me," I say in a small voice.
"No, you are quite brave," he says firmly. "Your situation was desperate and required desperate measures. You have your father's courage," he says and smiles a little. I can tell that he likes me, and I decide I like him very much. "I must tell your father. Blodwyn may have already done so when he knew you were within his reach. My spies told me he was aware you were coming several hours ago."
He starts walking back to his table, looking worried.
I don't hear Liviu's bird. It keeps banging and banging on the glass, but the sound doesn't mean anything to me. Finally, the vulture gives it up and crashes through the window, scattering glass in all directions. Shards of it slice my face and arms. Blood drips in my eyes and the vulture drops the scroll in front of me, physically pushing against my head to force me to read the words.
"Remus, your son is safe and unharmed at my castle. He is quite well. On this, you have my word of honour. If Blodwyn's message has reached you before mine, please take care before operating. He is not injured in any way. Leave you."
I realize Liviu has told me 3 times that Teddy is fine. He knows. Even with this, I'm shaking and telling myself to breathe. I start to feel things again, like the blood and tears running down my face and the cold gusts of air swirling through the shattered window. I read the parchment again and then a third time, and I get up and walk to the sink and wash my face. Teddy is safe. Teddy's alive. How in the hell did Liviu get him from Blodwyn's castle? Did he go there alone and fucking rescue him? It's impossible, but he must have done. And I couldn't feel Teddy because he was across a body of water in Europe. What the bloody hell was he doing in Europe? Tony. Frightened, stupid Tony, trying to escape the country, had taken my son with him, and it doesn't matter. Tony is safe. Teddy is safe. Nothing matters except for the fact that Teddy is safe. I don't think about Liz. I don't think about Annie. I jump up and apparate right into the middle of Livy's library. When Dad shows up about 15 feet from me with a loud bang, my first thought is that I'm in very big trouble. Very, very, very bad trouble. I look at Dad's face even though I'm scared to, because I know he's going to be angrier than he's ever been with me before. But he isn't. He's wearing his ratty denim trousers that he only wears in the house and an undershirt that's untucked, and his feet are bare and his hair is mussed up. He has little cuts and blood and glass on his face and his arms, and he looks like he's been crying. He's been crying because of me. I wish I were dead. And then he jumps over towards me and scoops me up in his arms, and we are both crying now, and he's hugging me so tight it feels like my chest is crunching, but I don't care. Dad, I bawl, and I don't even care if I sound girly. Dad, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for... I can't talk anymore because I've cried too hard. Dad smooths my hair and kisses me on the top of my head. Shh, he whispers. It's all right, Teddy. It's fine. Then I know Dad thinks about the prince because he puts me down on the couch and turns away like you better get over there quick and make it up to him. The prince doesn't seem angry that Dad's been ignoring him, though. He looks kind of awkward and uncomfortable, really. Like he doesn't know what he should do. But my dad knows exactly what he is going to do. He walks right up to the prince and hugs him. And the prince splutters and gets all red in the face, which is an odd thing to see on a vampire. Dad stands back and puts his hands on the prince's shoulders. Anything you want of mine is yours, he says in a serious voice. Whatever you ask of me, I shall do it. The prince smiles, and he looks very friendly and happy when he does it. Kingsley's wrong about him. He's not trying to trick Dad, and I know it. He really, really likes him. He's just old and lonesome and has finally found a friend that he can be best mates with, and he's very happy about it. And why wouldn't he be? My dad is always right.
That is a very dangerous offer you make,
the prince says in his lazy, flirty voice, and then I remember he's gay, and that Tony has a dirty crush on him, and that Tony's still in my bag. I reach down to the floor and yank open my knapsack, and out rolls the little bat right onto the floor. His eyes are open and glassy, but then they start blinking.
I don't care, Dad tells the prince, what you did.
A loud squishy sound interrupts him as Tony explodes out of the little bat. He's sitting on the floor with his legs sprawled out and his clothes and hair all rumpled up. I don't think either the prince or Dad is happy to see Tony. I should say my dad is really not happy to see Tony. He's narrowing his eyes and staring at him, and that is never a good sign.
Oh my, 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 what a state I am in!
Tony wails and jumps up, trying to arrange his crooked cravat and the wrinkled frock coat and tangled up curls. I don't think his clothes and hair are what he should be worrying about.
Tony,
Dad says. He does not introduce him to the prince. Tony looks at Dad, then at me, then at the prince, and lets out a big gasp and falls down on one knee.
Your Majesty,
he wails.
I am your servant, Antonin Greenniddle. I beseech thee to forgive my importunate appearance and my dreadfully dishevelled attire.
The prince is not who Tony should be worrying about, but he still doesn't get it. Sometimes he's thick as a plank.
Tony,
Dad says in this scary, flat voice,
would you be so kind as to tell me why you took my son to a Death Eater's castle tonight? Why you brought him to a man who could have killed him had Prince Radu not intervened?
And now Tony finally gets it. He gulps so big you can see his Adam's apple bobbing up and down, and the strangled sound comes out of his mouth.
Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, please do forgive me!
He screams and bursts into tears. It was that accursed wine. I woke on a train in Rhyme and the ferryman and Teddy was power. And now he's bawling too hard to say anything else. I was meant to help him find the asylum, I tell Dad loudly. He didn't know I'd be in danger. I was going to help him find the asylum and then go home. And I thought I would get home before morning and no one would miss me. I reckon the prince a very bossy person, because suddenly he jumps in and takes over everything.
This Antonin Greenlittle,
the prince asks Dad calmly and waves his hand at Tony.
Has he been a loyal friend to you?
Dad sighs, and I know then he's not going to kill Tony.
Yes, for a very long time.
He looks at Tony and shakes his head like, what am I supposed to do?
Tony was with me night and day after the First War, and when Sirius died, he was the only one who... Well, he knew what I was feeling. Nobody talks about it much, but after Sirius died, I guess everyone just worried about poor Harry, who really didn't even hardly know him, and about the other people there that got hurt. Nobody seemed to notice. Dad just saw his best mate die right in front of him. And I'm not saying this to be mean to Harry. Harry's the one who told me about it because he feels badly now. He was hollering at everyone that they were all heartless miscreants, Dad says and smiles a little. And when Nymphadora died, well, he helped with everything, with Teddy and the house and doing the books and... Well, I don't know how I would have got on without him.
The prince nods and speaks out very decisively.
Then, as he has expressed his utmost apology and begs your forgiveness, perhaps you shall be inclined to be gracious today?
I guess this is some private joke between him and my dad, because Dad starts laughing. Then he and the prince look at each other all girly and sweet, and I know if Quentin would hear, he'd tell Dad to just go on and give the prince a kiss then. It's usually good that Quentin is not here. Tony stops blubbering into his magenta handkerchief and blows his nose, just as Barnabas comes back into the room. Barnabas looks very surprised and shocked, but I don't know what about.
Your Majesty,
he begins,
forgive me.
But what? Tell me what? The prince says cheerfully, like nothing bothers him at all.
The servants tell me the dungeon repairs are complete.
That's because I repaired them, Dad says.
Yes, yes, of course, Captain Lupin.
Barnabas bows quickly and keeps talking.
A prisoner was found in the dungeons.
Both Dad and the prince seem very interested in this.
How'd someone get in there? Dad says. And why in hell would they want to?
You got in there, Dad, I remind him, when you went to rescue Dragomir. Barnabas gives me a very strange look, although I don't know why.
Yes.
Well, that is ironic, I suppose,
he says.
What is ironic about it?
The prince says snappishly. I think he wants Barnabas to hurry up and get to the point, but Barnabas does not want to get to the point at all. He looks over at Dad like he's asking for help, but Dad just shrugs because he's as confused as everyone else. Who is it? He says.
Dmitri Lupescu, Your Majesty.
He clears his throat and acts like he's going to leave, but the prince jumps up very fast.
What? How is this possible? Who has captured him?
He was not captured,
Barnabas says, and keeps sidling towards the door to the kitchen.
He was found there. He says he has no idea how he was placed there.
The prince looks at Dad like this is all his fault, and then says in a demanding way,
Well, what of it? How has this happened?
Don't ask me.
Bring me his head on a platter. Bring me his head on a platter.
The prince says to Barnabas,
and be quick about it.
Tony lets out a little gasp, but I think it will be cool to see a head on a platter, especially if it's a vampire head, because it won't be dead and it will still be talking.
Well, Your Majesty, Lupescu claims he's been given asylum from England and that he is under their protection,
Barnabas stammers out. He's just about halfway through the door now. That means he's under Dad's protection. This is going to be good.
Is this true?
The prince barks at Dad, and Dad looks embarrassed. Well, Shacklebolt gave it to him, but I suppose I asked him. The prince closes his eyes, like he can't bear to see any of us any longer.
Then bring him to me whole, he snaps, and we shall see what we shall see.